Working Cows Podcast, episode 199.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Egg Network. Very excited to be joined today by Shannon Sims. Shannon is a rancher in the mountains of McFadden, Wyoming, and he's been doing some interesting and out of the box things for a long time there. We talked to his wife way back on episode 3 about windrow grazing, and we are talking to him today about moving away from kind of some industry standard breeding methods, and talking to him today about using or raising your own bulls. So should be an interesting conversation with Shannon today. Looking forward to it. Shannon, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Excited to finally get to do this. You know, you interviewed Melinda like episode 3,
right?
And so it's about time I get to, you know, get on the same level as Melinda. She's been the only expert in the house for like 3 years now.
Oh man. Yeah, I know. I actually said that in the when I was introducing this episode at the end of 198, I said I reached out to you actually originally to do that episode, and it was a kind of a ironic situation as I remember it. We were talking about swath grazing, and you couldn't do the episode on swath grazing because a load of hay showed up and you had to go unload it. So
yes. Yep. So we will always be humbled in one way or another.
It was great. It was great. Nothing wrong with having a little emergency stockpile around, you know, so.
Well, and just set the record straight. It was alfalfa hay, so it was supplement to go with the protein. It was supplement, not substitute, okay?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking at hay right now, and it's pretty wild. And I guess when you start to think of it as substitute or supplement rather than substitute, that makes a big difference. When you're saying, I'm feeding this instead of $250 a ton cake, Maybe it starts to feel a little better.
Yes.
But we're here to talk today about transitioning to a closed herd, if that's the right way of phrasing this discussion, I guess. But I guess what I'd like to give you an opportunity to do, first of all, is kind of just share some of the history of your operation, specifically as it relates to breeding decisions and some of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if closed herd is the right term either. This is all so new to me. I don't know if I have all the right terms. There's closed herds and open herds and inbreeding and line breeding, and we're flirting with all of those, but I don't know if I really understand what any of them mean. But just a little background. My dad and grandpa started AI and cows in 1975. So I don't know if that quantifies them as an innovator or an early adopter. But they were early on, and AI'd heifers, cows, they even tried horses 1 year. Every year from then until 2 years ago, we dropped the AI program. So there's a lot of history and a lot of identity that can be built into something like that. When you're taking on a new technology, adopted early, even our neighbors kind of started to identify us as the people that utilize AI in the cow herd when nobody else was. And even there's records, and they weighed calves every year in the fall. And when they added the AI to the program, it boosted 205 day weights by 60 pounds the first year. So a big change. And then also just the phenotype of the cattle. I remember Dad talking about riding through the herd prior to AI and another nice calf, and after about a decade of pretty good. So there's a lot of good things that came from the use of AI, some big change. But what happened for us is in 1989, they went to a holistic management school and started learning more about grazing and implemented a cell grazing of sorts, started dividing pastures and rotationally grazing, but continued to AI in the years. At 14, we hired Roland Cruz to come in and help us rewrite our holistic context, holistic goal. And, you know, we don't have time to go through that right now. I've found as a mission statement works, it works well on a podcast too. Inspired business, producing quality life, personal growth, utilizing genetics that are coming from a farm in North Dakota or a ranch in North Texas, wasn't really moving us towards quality livestock adapted to our environment. And if you read in our holistic context, that's what we mean by quality livestock is livestock that can survive in our area on our resources. And we all live in very unique places, but it is unique in McFadden. You know, the truckers refer to as the snook about it, you know, 90 mile an hour winds with kind of cow to thrive here, and utilizing outside genetics, improved genetics that are built for growth, built for milking and stuff like that, was taking us backwards. And then we add into that our part of the mission statement that is a healthy environment. Putting cows into the same set of pens at the same time of year means you have to have some surrounding paddocks that are getting used the same time of year by the same number of cows. And that goes against some of the grazing principles that we believe in, which is using different pastures at different times of the year to try to build diversity. And so those two aspects of our holistic context moved us away from AI. And it made it a lot easier to let go of that legacy that we had built around AI, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. How long was that decision process? I mean, the Roland Cruz coming in, the holistic management school in 1989, but the AI goes all the way back to 1975. How long did you spend kind of thinking about going away from AI before you actually did it?
You know, I don't think the thought ever crossed anybody's mind until 2014, when we rewrote that context and we started to kind of question if it was taking us in the right direction. 2016, there was some other circumstances besides just our goals, but we moved away from the heifers, AIing heifers in that year. And then last year, so 2020 was the first year we didn't artificially inseminate the cows. So it took a while for us to go ahead and make that move. And we talked about it every year. And there was always a reason to go ahead with it. But we finally pulled the plug on the cows just 2 years ago.
Gotcha.
And now we have all kinds of time for other stuff in the summers. You know, the time that we spent synchronizing cows or heat detecting, those are all behind us. And we have time for, you know, the other day, Dad and my son Kagan went out and split up some pastures into 80 acre paddocks. And so we're moving cattle a little bit more rapidly. And today, probably, putting in cedars and whatnot today, but Buffalo for an environmental stewardship tour. And so, you know, there's been some positives come out of this already, besides the livestock portion of it.
We're struggling with the internet connection here, Shannon. Could I call you on the phone? Would that work or not?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, what were the motivations? I mean, you mentioned the quality of life or being able to, you know, increase the management, cutting up some pastures with temporary, I'm assuming, into some 80 acre paddocks and, you know, increasing that stock density and some of those things. What were some of the other motivations for moving away from AI?
You know, one of the bigger motivations was the use of synchronization drugs. And so we couldn't afford to spend 21 days AI in cows, you know, heat detecting on natural cycles and whatnot. So everything was synchronized. And we kind of started wondering if those cows were building a reliance on the drugs to cause them to cycle. And we're seeing a little bit of evidence of that. And it's not just us. I've got a neighbor that's kind of going through the same thing and seeing the same deals. Those cows are starting to rely on the inputs to get the cycle. And so, you know, our biggest driver of profit, I believe, according to Steve Campbell on the Working Cows podcast, is a live calf. You know, well, that's fertility. And if our cows are relying on outside inputs to get pregnant, we're going backwards. And so that was a driving force. And then also, I don't know, probably repeating myself, but the biggest driver is we need to build an animal that can survive our climate. So 7,200 feet, long winters, you know, we get the first frost September. If we're lucky, it's early in October. And then we get the last snowstorms in, a lot of times it's the first week of May. I've seen it snow as late as the 23rd of June just last year. Most of the old timers around here see snow all 12 months, seen snow 12 months. And so we needed a cow to fit here, and there's no sense, you know, raising a bull, collecting him, and then turn around and use that to keep the bragging rights of we AI, you know, why not just go natural service? So those are kind of the big driving forces.
And what have you gone to from there? I mean, you were AIing. Were you AIing with some of your own home raised bulls, or what were you AIing with?
We collected two of our own bulls and AI'd with them, but we used a lot of ABS, select sires. We used a lot of really good bulls, and I don't want to be misinterpreted in this. There's a lot of really good bulls that move our genetic program in the right direction. But to find a complete package that can thrive here, that's not too high of milk, that has some carcass, and number one, has excellent fertility, that's a hard bull to find and then bring him up here. And so now we raise all of our own bulls. We raise all of our own heifers. In order for a bull to get to stay in our program, he's got to be born to a cow that calved in the first 21 days of the calving period. From the first due date, you know, so it's not from the first calf born, but from the first due date. They've got to be born within the first 21 days. The first 3 years of their productive life. They can never calve in the last 21 days. They have to be bred every year. And we'd never have to pull a calf or otherwise run that cow through the chute, except for normal maintenance kind of vaccinations, preg checking, that kind of stuff. If she can make it through those criteria, her first 3 years, then we'll keep bulls out of her. And then once we've kept that bull, he'll stay on the cow through the winter. And come into February, into March, then we'll go ahead and wean. And they just go right onto a hay ration. And we're not trying to grow them out very big. We're not trying to put any weight on them. We're not even trying to get them to breed that first year. We just want to know who can survive in our climate. And so once they've made it through that loop, then we'll pap test them 7,200 feet. You know, we run a lot of risk of brisket disease up here. And so everything gets pap tested, fertility tested, and ugly tested. So they've got to have some, we try not to get too worried about phenotype, but they've got to have some semblance of good confirmation to them. And if they can make it through those, then they get to be a breeding bull in the herd. And then on the female side, every heifer born on the place gets a chance to be a cow. And so no supplement during the summers. They just stay on the cow. And then through the winter, we feed the cow to balance the ration, to meet her needs. And so if our hay test is a little bit low, you know, if it's only 6% protein, we'll go ahead and supplement with some alfalfa. But those heifers stay on the cow until the same time frame, end of February, 1st of March. Then we'll wean them off. And they go on to our best hay if we have to. A lot of times our best hay is 9% protein with, you know, 60% TDN or thereabouts. And if we don't have very good hay, we will supplement. But we haven't had to do that for about 4 or 5 years now. And we take advantage of compensatory growth starting in May. And then the 8th of July or thereabouts, we turn the bulls in. This year it's going to be for 21 days because I've got a bet with a couple of guys on a WhatsApp group that see who can have the highest breed up doing this. So I got to stick to the 21. Prior to now, it's been 24 to 30 days that they get a chance to breed. And at the end of that, everything that's bred gets to be a cow, and everything that's not is a stalker and is sold to the highest bidder. And that all came from, really, I think a lot of that came from Glenn Barlow, but I learned about it through Burke Tykert. And so I've got to give credit where credit's due. None of these ideas were really ours. They're, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants here. Mm.
Yeah, as far as the challenging your heifers with a shorter breeding season?
Yes. Yep.
Gotcha.
And then also with the bull development, I think a lot of that, the first 3 years, the cow's got a calf in the first three cycles, that came directly from Burke. And I think he picked that up. If it wasn't from Glenn Barlow, it was Gerald Fry. But I think that was Glenn that is where he picked that up. And so we're just copying some other people and able to do it on our scale for our purposes.
Right. I think the first paragraph of Joel Salatin's article in the Stockman Grass Farmer this month or last month says that Alan Nation said, "I'm just a pollinator bee flitting from one, you know, idea to the next and just cross pollinating ideas," you know. So I think there's always a lot of that. I think episodes with Troy Bishop, he was mentioning a lot of these same names too, Glenn Barlow and Gerald Fry and you know, sending cows out to New York to get them closer to a market that was willing to pay for grass-finished beef and stuff like that. So all kinds of, I think there's a lot of cross-pollination that happens and I guess just that commitment to being willing to innovate, not do the same thing all the time, and a lifelong learning is probably as much of a part of making this change as anything.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And another name to throw in there is Steve Campbell. You know, 40% of profitability comes from a live calf, 30% feed resource, 20% calf growth, and 10% carcass. And an awful lot of the industry focus is on carcass right now. Which is only 10% of our profit. And meanwhile, what we're running into, a really dry year, our cows did not perform well from a fertility aspect. And so 2016, we grew all kinds of feed, lots and lots and lots and lots of feed. And then it turned dry and they couldn't do anything with it. And we ended up with only 70% of the herd conceiving that year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not rare in this country. So our options are to find a cow that works here or to prop them up. Mm. And propping them up just keeps getting more and more and more expensive. Although, thanks to Steve Campbell, I think maybe salt can prop them up a lot more than I've realized. So,
I just made my first...
There's some options.
I just made my first batch of mineral water yesterday, so...
Oh...
Giving
we'll
it
have
a shot.
To talk after this.
we're just giving it a shot. Nothing died, so you know, one day and we're good. But so, anyways, So I love that the you know not propping them up, finding the cows that can work in your environment. Have there been commonalities? First question, how long have you been keeping your own bulls for natural service? Are we just a year into this or just getting started? Where are you at in this game?
The answer is yes, honestly. So part of the advantage of using AI is we've been able to keep our own cleanup bulls, just bred a little group of cows separate and kept our own cleanup bulls for as long as I can remember. I've been on the ranch since 2001. And as a kid, I don't remember buying bulls. So we've been doing that for a long time. This will just be the second year that we've used our own genetics strictly. And so you're going to have to kind of prime me here again. What was your question, Clay?
Just kind of how long you've been doing it. And I guess if there was any commonalities that you've been seeing as far as cows that produce calves that can become bulls, phenotypical commonalities within the bull herd, any of those things as you've been kind of selecting your own genetics to become breeding stock.
The one that's really stood out to me, so the bull side of it is pretty new and fresh, not very far along. The heifer side of it, we've been doing that regime with the short breeding season and the more time on the cow. We've been doing that since 2014. And so we're starting to see some commonalities in the heifers that perform. And one of the big ones that stood out to me was went out through the two-year-old the other, well, went out through the cows and was really taking note of the two-year-olds. And probably 25% of those had a good calf on them and still had a bunch of dead hair. And, you know, that would have been around the 1st of July. And the other 75% were shed off. And when we first started this, I'll bet you it was 50-50. So I think, you know, and that's kind of a standard metric that Steve Campbell uses is the early shedding. Troy Smith, I think it's Trent Smith from Mississippi State, you know, he subscribed to that for a long time, that you've really got to find the early shedders, and that gives you a good idea. And I think we're not actively looking for anything, because I feel like every time we get involved, we screw it up. You know, we chase carcass traits in our herd in the mid-90s, and we basically ruined fertility. And so I'm afraid to start trying to select cattle, because I don't know what else is going on. What I know is if they can raise a calf and I don't have to touch her, she's a good cow. And so we're staying out of it, but we're starting to see the shedding present itself. And then, I mean, there's no sense me redoing a Kit Farrow episode. We're getting cows that have more girth. They've just got more capacity. I can't say that we're seeing frame score fours. We're probably seeing fives to five and a halves. And I do wonder about, just because of our region, we're a lot further north than Cheyenne Wells. I don't know if you've seen a white-tailed deer in the plain, in the brush country of Texas, but they're a lot smaller than they are here. Yep. And I almost wonder if it takes a little bit more of a sizable cow to just fill up on low quality feed and might explain some of that. But, you know, definitely not sixes and sevens for a frame score.
Right.
So that's been pretty obvious. Nothing else really stands out. I suppose we have a lot better udders now, just because, but I, you know, that's a tough one. The industry as a whole has really worked on that. So I don't know if that's our selection or the industry selection.
Yeah, I've always heard that getting animals getting bigger as they go north, related to lung capacity, actually, that you need a bigger lung capacity to survive in a cold winter, I guess. You know, that's what it's always been to me, or what I've always heard it attributed to, I guess. But what were some of the challenges, or what were some of the things that held you back from making this change sooner?
There was the legacy factor that we've already discussed. And then you give up a lot of control over your genetics and kind of put it in nature's hands or God's hands, or however you wanted to describe it, whatever you subscribe to. But you're giving up a lot of control, and that's hard for you know, our family operates on 25,000 acres and has it split into 145 different paddocks. We're used to having a lot of control of what we manage. And so giving that up was difficult. And then there's just the unknowns. There's a fine line between line breeding and inbreeding. And we don't know where we're at on that for sure. Although I will say my man, Joe Hatch, has helped me a bunch on that. He sent me a, piece of literature, and what that says is if you've got more than 300 head, you're not going to have a significant problem with inbreeding. And then along with that, inbreeding is just nothing more than lining up the recessives. And so there's, as long as you can do it within a economical way, there's nothing wrong with having some cattle fall out from some genetic traits. You know, the genetic abnormalities. So I suppose those were the biggest challenges, and it's the people. It's always people. There you go. There's another name of somebody on your podcast, Alan Crockett, right? Mm. Every problem is a people problem.
Yep. Yep.
And I think that's even true with this.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll quote the Stockman grass farmer again. I think it was Alan Williams said, when it works, it's line breeding. When it doesn't, it's inbreeding.
Yeah. And when it works, it was my idea. And when it doesn't, it was somebody else's idea.
Yeah. What are some things you wish you would have known before you got started?
I don't know if I wish I would have known it before I got started. I wish we would have adopted some of the DNA testing a lot sooner. We still have the horn gene in our herd, and there is no reason for that. DNA testing could eliminate that so fast. And so that was one of the things that we brought along in making this move is primarily we're DNA testing for some things like calving ease, and heifer pregnancy and stayability. That's really what we're using it for. But then we add to that, the horn gene. And so anything that's carrying the horn gene goes, anything that's got horns, obviously they never get to be a bull, but anything carrying the horn gene, they go into our lease bulls. You know, some people are not worried about that. We are. I wish I would have adopted that a lot sooner. I think also knowing that our genetics are good enough for what we need to do, I wish I would have understood that sooner. Just in that everything you hear is all about carcass, and they've got a great choice, and they've got to be a yield grade 3 or less. And if you don't use the right genetics, they're never going to finish. And there's some validity to that, but we've kind of peaked. We've kind of topped out. And again, we don't need to redo some of your previous podcasts, but we haven't made much genetic progress in the way of weight or even carcass traits for that matter in probably 20 years, you know? And so much of that can be turned on and off with some epigenetics and that kind of stuff. So just a better understanding of genetics would have helped us immensely.
What do you see as the future going forward? What are you thinking as far as you're just getting started with this? Do you have any further ways that you plan to roll this out or make use of this tool?
You know, ultimately, I think this is going to be a marketing tool, and not marketing genetics, not marketing breeding stock or anything like that. But when you have a fertile cow herd, you have a lot of flexibility. And so if I can sell pregnant cows because I've got lots of pregnant heifers, my playbook is wide open. And so I think that's where the ultimate goal is to get to right now in 21 days or in one cycle, we're getting about 70% of our heifers pregnant. Last year we had a drought where we were 55. If we can start moving that needle up just a little bit, maybe get 75, maybe even get to 80%. And I'm talking like 15 to 20 years down the road, because I think those changes are going to be slow and it still relies on weather and whatnot. But if we can start getting more of those young cattle pregnant, that means I can sell, some of those 4-year-old cows that have peaked in their, appreciation and will start to depreciate, that don't have the genetic package that we want. And I think there's a lot of potential in marketing those cattle. And then again, you know, I talked about the 70%. We had a similar year last year. It was really dry. We grew some decent feed, got super dry on us. Instead of being a 70% preg rate, we were 80%. I'm hoping that, again, 25 years from now, my kids will be able to take advantage of the fertility in our herd. It doesn't matter if we get 10 inches of precip or if we get 20 inches of precip. We're going to be 85 to 90% pregnant, or maybe even 93% pregnant, without any inputs. And I think it's doable. It's going to take a lot of pressure, but that's the direction we're headed. And I talk about the carcass traits and whatnot. We're using the DNA panel. I don't want those to fall by the wayside. We still have to produce a quality product for the consumer, because at the end of the day, all of this is just an exercise in, well, not futility, but it's just for fun if we don't have somebody buying the product on the backside. And so if we can get a highly fertile cow with a good eating experience for the consumer, that's ultimately where we want to arrive at. But right now, I want to really focus on the fertility.
It's not an exercise in futility, it's an exercise in fertility.
Oh, you've come so far.
That was a bad one. Could you have done this without 44 years of AIing, or is that a help or a hindrance in your mind at this point?
I really appreciate that question, because I've wrestled with that a lot too. The reason, are we able to do this because of those 40 years or in spite of? And mm-hmm. I really don't have an answer. What I do know is, utilizing the AI, a lot of the convenience traits built into our herd that we would have got there without AI, but it would have taken a lot longer, I think. But on the flip side, we lost a lot of the fertility and whatnot that was already in this herd. A lot of the adapted components of these cattle, it used to be nobody supplemented. Cattle survived on salt and grass for the summer and hay for the winter, and they did fine, you know. And then we started figuring out we could make a little bit extra just by throwing out some alfalfa, throw out some cake, feed some mineral, improve the genetics, you know, all these little things. And so it could have taken us backwards a long ways too. And I think it just depends on which traits you're tracking. And that kind of brings me back around single, you know, trait selection. It's so easy with an AI program to start chasing a single trait, whether it's pounds, whether it's carcass, whether it's fertility. You've got to have the whole package, and it just makes it way too, with all the data that we have. And you and Craig Guffey just talked about this the other day. We have so much data now. It's really hard to roll that all into one package and get a good animal that works across the board for every phase of the industry. You know, not only work as a cow, but work for the next guy. We sell all of our steer calves to a backgrounding lot, and then they go into a finishing lot, and then everybody's got to make money down the line, and the single trait selection makes that very difficult.
You mentioned a term earlier, convenience traits. Is that like calving ease, or what else might be included there?
Yeah, the calving ease, the docility, and maybe that shouldn't be considered a convenience, because if they're not docile, they don't get to stay here, but it is somewhat of a convenience trait. And then I would, maybe convenience is not the right word, but I would throw some of the carcass traits in there too, because you and I both know that you just talked about this the other day. The 4-year-old cow that you just ate was just as good of a eating experience as the calf that's been finished on grain for 200 days and graded choice. And so much of that is just in the way it's prepared and its life leading up to slaughter day.
Are you guys retaining ownership on anything or not?
No, okay. We got away from that completely. You know, we used to retain ownership, but man, I didn't enjoy. You could always make money in the feedlot if you knew how to hedge them right, and if you spent a lot of time buying and selling puts and calls and options and all that stuff. And, you know, if I wanted to do that stuff, I probably would have gone into business school and been a broker somewhere instead of ranching. And I would much rather go move temporary fence and, select heifers and bulls and that kind of stuff than I would worrying about, hedging cattle. So we got away from that. And that's not to say that we won't get back into it. You know, some of that depends on what the market's telling us, but right now, it's so much easier to just sell those calves in the fall and let somebody else take advantage of those genetics.
Sure. So calving in the mom, the dam needs to calve in the first 21 days for the first 3 years, never the last 21 days, and never have to pull a calf or give attention to her outside of a time when everybody else is going through the chute too. Are there other criteria? I mean, you mentioned some phenotypical, not ugly, some of those things. Are there other criteria going forward after they've passed all those hurdles and you've turned him out for a year? Is there anything that you guys are watching for or paying attention to?
Yeah, obviously the docility. But really after that, there's always feet and leg issues. And so we'll watch for that. But really, we don't have a lot of problem with that. And I'm knocking on wood because as soon as I say that, I'll go out and find 10 head of lame bulls with our heifers. But no, sometimes the worst thing I do, and I think we're all guilty of this, is overcomplicate things. Mm. And if they're a fertile bull with a low PAP score, that's from a genetic package that has proven herself on our place, I don't know that I really need to worry about much more than that. Like I say, we'll use the DNA test, and if that 12-panel test comes back and he's a 1 for tenderness and a 1 for quality grade, we'll probably not use him very long, if at all. You know, but beyond that, no, we're keeping it just as simple as possible. I guess the other thing I should mention is, we keep the genetic turnover pretty fast on our bulls. So they get a year off. That first year, they get to grow. The next 4 years, they get to breed, and then we're done with them. And, you know, you and Craig talked about that the other day, and I don't think he's wrong, and I don't think that we are wrong. Part of the reason we do that is because they start to get a little bit more ornery. The older they get, we start to run into a little bit more of concern for disease, and my fences are not spectacular, and so we have cattle getting out and whatnot. We have neighbors that run good cattle right next to us, but there's always that risk. And then they just don't cover country as well. They get heavy, just like you and Craig were talking about. 1-ton bull on our landscapes, lots of hills, lots of steep hills, and having to travel to and from water, they don't hold up nearly as well as a young, lighter bull weighing 1,600 pounds.
Yeah, it was going to be a question too. Do you know anything about mature bull size on some of the AI sires you were using, and how does mature bull size of what you're using now compare?
You know, that would be really hard for me to answer very well, Clay. You know, they print that stuff. You can look at it's bulls, and a lot of the bulls we used, yeah, their mature weight was 2,200, 2,300, 2,400 pounds, but that's not the genetic package. That's feeding. And right, that's a right. bull that's hanging out in the stud his whole life. And and so comparing those to our bulls is pretty tough, because our bulls, if they get supplemented, it's almost an accident. They'll run with the cows during the winter, and so they might get a little bit of alfalfa. They get pulled out around the 1st of April and go to grass, and they get turned in with the cows again in with the heifers on the 8th of July, in with the cows on the 22nd of July. And then once we pull them, they go back to the grass, and they stay on grass just as long as we can. And last winter, it was a wide open winter, and so they got to come in off of the hills. And by hills, I mean our upland pastures, sagebrush step. They got to come down to the hay meadows and hang out in the brush mid-January. And so they're just never going to – we don't give them enough groceries to get them that big, honestly.
Yeah, right.
So that's a hard comparison to make.
anything else that you think is an important piece of this that you want to make sure gets communicated? I got a question from Derek Schwanebeck, so prepare yourself. But anything else you wanted to communicate as far as these things are concerned?
Yeah, you know, something I kind of glossed over, and it's going backwards pretty bad, but I think it's a big part of this. We're leaving those calves on the cow for 9 to 10 months. That allows us to test the calf a little bit, but the real reason for that is it takes 10 months on milk for a calf's rumen to fully develop. And I think that's allowing us to get away with some of these other practices that we're using, such as the short breeding season, the compensatory growth, just because that rumen is so far along. And so this whole project started with the holistic goal, holistic context. Yeah, I'm aging myself. I keep calling it holistic goal. but then it moved into how do we build a cow that fits here? And our first step in that was to leave the heifer calves on the cow until the rumen had fully developed. And then that step led us into the next phase of let's give every heifer a chance. And then we started not AIing heifers, partially because they weren't very big, and it's really hard to AI a 650-pound heifer, but partially because we wanted to test them a little bit more. And then that ultimately led into completely abandoning our AI program. So everything's got to operate in a whole. Every decision affects some other component. And, I think it's very important to just step back and look at a person's entire operation and understand the far-reaching implications of a decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there other?
Do I have to answer questions from? Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yes, it's a great one. So, are there other reasons that this was right for you guys? I mean, you mentioned a couple of times the holistic context. You mentioned a couple of times cows that fit your environment. But are there other reasons that this was right for you guys?
Yeah, I think I only mentioned once quality of life, and AIing is not the most fun, and I enjoyed it for a long time. My dad enjoyed it for way longer, and one of our neighbors was a little bit upset with us when we dropped the AI, just thinking we were completely going backwards. And my dad said to the neighbor, he said, "I'm not getting any younger, and this is work." Right. And so there comes a stage in everybody's life. Something else is different from when I was a kid. We worked on the ranch. There wasn't a lot of outside activities that we participated in. Whereas my kids are, they're going to basketball camps, they're going to judging camps. They're on the move, and they're getting, I don't want to, hold them back from that because we've got to AI cows this week, or we've got to move cows closer to the pens this week. And so there's a lot of that family part of it that played into this as well.
Right. Yep. And definitely breeding is one of those things that kind of needs to be done in a specific window of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Especially here, if you do it too soon, you get the calve in ice. And if you do it too late, you don't have to worry about calving because they never bred, because everything is turned and there's no nutrition left in the feed, So it is. Yeah. There's a very specific window for us.
Very good. Shannon, I really appreciate your time today, but I do have this burning question from Derek that I wanted to get your answer to, if you're prepared.
I doubt that I'm prepared for a Derek question, but I'll try.
Hey, Derek, a question for Shannon is, what's the difference between a goldfish and a bubble-dyed goldfish?
Did you catch that?
I did catch that. They both believe they're normal. There is no actual difference. Oh, yeah. I don't know if you're going to be able to include this on the episode. I have a really great video of two normal goldfish and then the bubble-eyed goldfish that thinks he's normal.
Yeah.
I might have accused Derek of being a bubble-eyed or goggle-eyed goldfish.
The only, so the only thing that comes through on Google Voice is the transcript, and it's not always right. This one in this case, it got it mostly right. So I was like, I this is an inside joke, but it'll be great.
Okay.
So Shannon, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh man, thank you. It's always fun. It's fun to try to explain some of what we do. It clarifies it in my mind a little bit more. So thank you for the opportunity.
Very good stuff there with Shannon. Really, really appreciate him taking the time to share his experience early on in this process with me, and look forward to talking to him a little bit more as he gets farther into it and seeing what kind of results they continue to get from that. Coming up next week, episode 200 of the Working Cows podcast, and we'll just leave you hanging. It's going to be a special treat, and hopefully the rest of these episodes in the early 200s work out. I got a few things in the works that I'm really excited to share with you. So come on back next week for a very special episode 200 of the Working Cows podcast. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.